All right, everyone, welcome to our Parsha class. This week, Parsha's Toldot. It's the fifth class. And the topic is the joy of having children, manageable pain, or wonderful payoff.
Hi, Rabbi.
Hello, Ruth, and we see you live. We see you. Welcome aboard.
Thanks. I'm going to walk away now because I've got stuff in the oven.
No problem.
Thanks. But I hear you.
That's good. And we got Shmuel as well. We got two Bornsteins.
That's right.
One time we got two Bornsteins. Mendel doesn't show up.
That's unbelievable.
Not cool.
He will hear
about this. He will hear.
Yeah, he better.
All right. So we're getting into Parshas Toldos. We're getting into Rivka's infertility, pregnancy, and the like. All right. So we're going to start off with a little video. So I'm going to now share a screen. With the sound, this is called the Baby Boss from DreamWorks. Does everybody see this?
Yeah.
All right, here we go.
I'm in heaven, and my heart beats so that I can hardly speak. When we're out together, dancing cheek to cheek, and I seem to find happiness I see. I'm in heaven. Dancing cheek to cheek. All the wings seem to vanish like a gambler's lucky streak. And the cares that hung around me, and to reach the highest peak, but it doesn't thrill me.
Remember, the baby was delivered in a taxi.
Look who's here.
Meet your new baby brother. This guy, why is he here? What's with that outfit? Why is he so fat? Why is he staring at me? Does he know karate? What's going on? One thing was clear. He was the boss. He set up his office right smack dab in the middle of the night.
Where's the bottle?
He has to have his bottle!
He had everyone wrapped.
Okay. But Daddy's here. Daddy's here.
Who's mommy's little cutie? It's mommy's little cutie.
No, he's daddy's little tough guy, right? You know, one of me and you.
Maybe the baby should decide. Who do you want to stay with you, Daddy or Mommy?
Why? Because he came out of nowhere. We don't even know him. How can we trust him?
Come on, he's just a baby.
Oopsie, I got it.
5 second rule.
Carries a briefcase. Does no one else think that's, I don't know, a little freaky?
Well, you.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are.
Trust me, one day you're going to get to know this little guy, and you are going to love him.
Okay, you got the basic idea. All right. Anybody seen that movie before? The Baby Boss?
No, but I feel thoroughly entertained by that little piece.
That's it. Those are the best scenes. All right, everybody see the sheet?
Yes.
All right, good. All right, here we go. Why are parents so happy to endure sleepless nights and running around caring for the babies?
Maybe it's evolution, you know? That baby's your genetics come to life.
Well, that is factually true, but why are they happy about it?
I don't know.
So if a person's happy, there's got to be some sort of psychological payoff, correct?
Yeah.
So what are the psychological payoffs of having a baby?
I haven't figured that out yet.
Right. Well, it's going to be harder for a guy to figure that out than a woman, but go ahead. Let's have the women folk perhaps give some insight here. Any ideas? I mean, you see parents are at least happy, at least initially, you know. What are they happy about? Do you like in general get woken up with a screaming anything? Generally not.
I mean, I don't mean to derail your mentor here, but I think it's a little presumptive to say that this is all women, or men, like, who says they enjoy it? Like, a lot of women and men presumably find that to be like a really difficult, painful, depressing period of their life.
No, correct. I didn't say they're happy when they're woken up at 3 a.m. because nobody is. You know what I'm saying? But they're happy to do, you know, shall we say, get involved in this. You know what I'm saying? Or at least most couples. I mean, there is, people have children, you know what I'm saying?
So, right.
So we have to assume, and they seem to not only have children, but most people are happy to have children. They're not happy to be woken up in the middle of the night. That's for sure not.
Can we just say that it's the primal need to procreate?
That's having sex. That's not having kids.
Right, but the result inevitably will be to have a kid, and you go into that knowing that.
Okay, so we have to sort of detangle what are some of the enjoyments of having children.
Well, I don't have kids, and
yeah.
Even though that you guys don't have kids right this exact second, but you are aware of, you may be an aunt or an uncle to children,
so
and you may see know people who have children, and you are once upon a time yourself were children. So the topic is not something which is absolutely foreign to everybody here. But give it a whirl.
But I'll tell you.
Go ahead, Suzanne. I'm sorry.
I'll tell you that I am very close with my nieces and nephew, and the joy that I get from them, and it's just, I can't imagine the joy that their parents get from them, because just from what I get from them, the love they give,
Stop right there. All right, boom, right there. So that's a big one. Let's just focus upon that. You have a child who, you automatically, in a certain sense, you're creating a loving relationship. You know what I'm saying? So, and not, you have child that there's a built-in, or at least the hope is, a loving relationship. Now, that might get derailed later on, but people have children, so that's one reason. People have children. I don't know the ranking of it. One, people have children basically to be loved. It's a process of self-love.
But it doesn't that kind of backfire, because not that children aren't loving, but like the way parents love children is definitely not the same as how children love parents.
Correct. So that's the fundamental struggle, because the challenge that the parent has to recognize is that I may love my child, but psychologically, that's fundamentally an expression of self-love, loving of myself.
But he, okay.
And therefore, when the parent, the child, and therefore, the question is, am I making decisions what's in the best interest of the child? Or am I making a decision which is the child serving my needs? That's the essence of the parenting. A parent has to be, even though they know that they're getting their own personal satisfaction, they have to know that that they cannot get blinded by that, because they have to really do what's in the best interest of the child. All right, so let's one look. What other reason, what other motivations are there for having children? Suzanne talked about the, now, is it the joy of being loved, or there's just a joy of the children? Is that the same thing, or is that two things?
I think there are two separate things.
So what's the joy? Let's see if we can reduce or clarify. What is the joy component?
I just see, like, watching my nieces and nephew grow up and go to school and learning things and, oh my gosh, it's so loud here.
Really loud.
You get such, I mean, you really are filled with joy watching them grow and have accomplishments and work through struggles and.
But let me ask you a question. Let's say, let's say they bring their friend over who's the exact same age, going the exact same thing. You're not going to get the joy of watching them go through life and develop in the same way.
No.
So it's really about them.
Right.
So it's not the interesting experience of watching children develop, which is cool. Objectively, it is cool. I mean, a child development is a very interesting thing. So why am I particularly more interested in my own particular relatives than another child who's the classmate of the kids?
Well, I think because
I was just going to say, because you
have small nets.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh, maybe because it's the parents who are helping to shape this individual into who they think they should be. And instill their values in this little human.
Right. So what's the joy of that? That sounds like a hassle.
I'm not disagreeing. Just kidding.
So there is a major part, which is when a person sees their child or their relative, they're looking into their legacy. One of the major unspoken fears of people, which comes out at occasional moments, which is the fear of mortality. I recognize I'm gonna die. So the children, who are an extension of the parent, create a sense of destiny, legacy, to the parent. So that's another satisfaction. That's another payoff. In fact, in Yiddish, a term for a child, people, I don't know if you've heard it called, they would call the child in Europe a kaddishel. What is a kaddishel?
It's someone to take kaddish for you.
Right, so the parent is calling the child a little bit morbid, if you think about that person who, when I am dead, will say kaddish for me. But it really refers to is, this is my testimony, my legacy to the world. This is what I'm leaving. This is what I'm leaving over. This is my quote unquote work of art to humanity. Well, that's a very powerful thing. Now, we also didn't talk about, going back to what Shmuel says, there's also a maternal instinct. most women will feel a desire. This goes back to what Ruthie pointed out from an evolutionary standpoint, a biological standpoint. There is an enjoyment of having children just as a satisfying of a biological instinct, a maternal instinct. Now, I'm not sure every woman has it feels it the same way, but there is a phenomena, and men feel that a lot less. Okay, so that's that. Now, I will identify, but there's also an additional satisfaction. What else is there? So let's review. We have one aspect of having children. It's a function of self-love. In other words, I literally created a loving relationship, right? There's a person who I will love to the end of my life, okay? And who will love me back, okay? I will love it. It will love me. Or at least that's what the hope is. A. Two is legacy, future, my destiny, in a certain sense, the child is my immortality. Or at least I feel it psychologically. Also biologically, there's a biological desire to have children. Then there's something that we haven't mentioned, which is more applicable to guys. What is the biggest motivator for men to have children? I'm not talking the desire to have sex.
Well,
what causes guys to actually decide to settle down and have a family? A major factor. John, what causes guys to want to settle down and have a family? Putting you on the spot.
Mm-hmm. I also think like a legacy is important.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it is a legacy aspect. Yes. In other words, because this child will be my continuation of me, that my children are here to replace me.
Even as something as simple as like the family name gets continued on through males.
Correct. What motivates guys who are not so naturally wanting to have a family? What pushes them to do that, especially in our society?
Security.
What?
Some sense of security, stability.
Okay. We unpack that a little more there, Shmuel.
I suspect that to some degree, especially in our society, that it's a certain symbol of status. It's a certain status symbol to be established, married,
right,
to procreate, have children, teach them how to be a good human being.
Right. Right, so there's a sense of status and dignity of having being a single guy, but married and a father. Our society still, by and large, respects that.
Now, yeah, if I can expand on that, it's also a certain obvious symbol of self-sacrifice that you don't continue to live purely for your own enjoyment, but you're willing to make personal sacrifices to supply for a family.
Well, that's a level of maturity. I don't think people are drawn to that. That's sort of something that they come to accept.
Okay.
There's another element, which I think is really, which we haven't mentioned yet, peer pressure. In other words, if all my friends are married, I feel like a big fat loser if I'm not married and I'm not having kids. Right? And that's very motivating, in other words, for the guys who don't have a biological clock, that factor is very motivating. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? You don't want to be the last guy of their quote-unquote group married. You know what I'm saying? There's a social pressure. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
Yes, Dad. You got the smile from Ruthie. All right. So therefore, putting this whole smorgasbord of motivation, why are parents so happy to endure? They don't like being woken up. But the, it's, in other words, all these satisfactions and enjoyments, it's worth the deal. You know what I'm saying? Now, therefore we broke out number two. Question number three, why do you think Hashem made babies, even baby animals, so cute, especially to the parents?
So they don't eat them.
So you don't eat the child?
No, like in the wild, like if like fathers are hungry, they'll like come home. Like not people, but maybe also people. Like groundhogs and foxes will like come home and eat the babies from the den.
Really? I did not even know that. All right, but let's start with the human world. Why do you think Hashem made the kid so darn cute?
I mean, can we also point out that a lot of babies are only cute to their own parents?
Right. I say, especially, in other words, this is...
Can we establish that?
So, Shmuel, first of all, I agree with you. In other words, if you have 100 babies, you're going to have your top 10% who are outstandingly, amazingly cute. The next 10% are less so. And then there are really, you know, back of a bus looking babies.
Yeah.
But that child, if you go to that mother and you say, Shmuel, you turn to them and say, you know, your child is suffering from a terminal case of cuteness, she will just say, Shmuel, thank you so much. She will believe that because that's how she feels.
Yeah.
She feels her kid, which has got the weird shaped head and awkward features, which basically best described as funny looking, is cute.
Those babies are cute too. It's true though. Those babies are adorable as well.
In an awkward kind of way. Right?
Yes, my favorite.
So my question is, why did Hashem make these babies cute?
Just to make that loving relationship easier and stronger?
Correct. Because raising kids, especially for the early years, is so stressful, so painful. If you didn't get the satisfaction of that these are so cute, you basically put them out in the front lawn with the garbage. or an expression of that, you know, one of the things that at the hospital, when you have a baby, the nurse will tell you about not to shake the baby. All right? Very dangerous. Why do parents shake the baby?
Make them shut up.
Yeah,
the baby's like crying for like, you know, 7 hours, and you're sleep deprived, and you're exhausted, and you just want nothing but the baby to be quiet. So you would want to give it a little shake. That I don't know how that's helpful, but whatever. Which of course can cause some permanent brain damage. So not good. So, but getting to the point so there's another enjoyment is that babies are very cute. I like little cute little babies. They are cute. I don't like them at 3 a.m. Less cute. But I had my share. I'm looking forward to be a grandfather because that's the best kind. You get the baby, you enjoy the baby. It's like Suzanne. You get the niece, you get the nephew, enjoy it, play a game, fun. And when it's like annoying, back to mom and dad, I'm bouncing and I'm out. Bye-bye. Now, going back to the baby boss video, what other truth about babies did the boss baby reveal? In a very clever way. Say it again. I can't hear.
Who are you waving at?
All right.
Children have a certain power over the household. Babies have a certain power over the household with their brattiness.
Correct. Basically, the baby, as exemplified by the boss baby, this baby shows up, and basically mom and dad are running around the house just serving the child hand and foot. Their entire schedule is directed by the baby. And, you know, by the way, the other siblings, that's not a simple thing because they used to be the star of the show, and now they've been passed over. So that's also psychologically very distressing. So the baby, you know, is basically dominating, bossing the mother to the totality, has total control over time. In other words, for the first 3 months, the mother is not the boss, the master of her time. She is basically the servant to the baby, by and large. So what aspect of babies are close to reality? Cuteness or bossiness?
It's all a matter of perspective.
It's as far as quantity of time. What do you say, Shayna? What aspects of babies is close to reality? Cuteness or bossiness?
Bossiness.
100% bossiness. Now, they're not verbalizing. They're not verbalizing in words, but when the baby is unhappy, the diaper is wet, the baby cries. The baby is hungry. The baby cries. The baby needs to be it needs to be burped. It cries, and the cry is really a call and a demand upon you, or the husband and wife to basically stop what they're doing, and play exclusive focus upon the immediate needs of this baby. So there is cuteness, but the bossiness is far in time-wise is far greater. I will just insert at this particular point that this is part of the reason that having a baby, you know, certainly interesting enough for men, not women, by the way, men have to have children. One, at least a male and a female. So why do you think the Torah made it an obligation?
What?
Why do you think the Torah made it a mitzvah to have children? In other words, a commandment to have two children.
Is it like a mitzvah or is it like an obligation?
A mitzvah means a command. People use the word mitzvah as like a good deed. That's not an accurate translation. Now, a mitzvah could also be a good deed, but a mitzvah is a command. It's an obligation.
I mean, I feel like people aren't like converting to Judaism in droves. Like,
correct.
Judaism is going to survive. Somebody's got to have a kid sometime.
No, 100%. So, but they're not leaving it up to a person's, what do you call it? Better and higher motivation. It's a mitzvah on all. Interesting enough, on men. Why it's not on women is a good question.
Is it a maturing?
Say issue? Again.
Is it an issue? Is it an opportunity for maturing?
It does create. It does force maturity. It does. It's not a guarantee. You see many parents who are immature.
Yeah.
They also might be bad parents.
Sure.
There is a category called parents fall into category as well. You have outstanding parents. You have above average. You have average. And then parents who suck.
Yeah, I know those guys.
Okay. All right. So they exist. You know what I mean? It doesn't, you don't need a degree to, you don't need a degree or a license to have a child. All right. So that's the bottom line. The bottom line is it's not simple, especially if you're doing it properly and it's not a function of your own ego, your own legacy, your own biology, and you're doing it to really produce a child who can be, from a Jewish perspective, raise him to be he or she, a good Jew, a decent Jew. That's a real hard job. And how many kids does the average European have?
Half.
Half a child?
Yeah. On average. Where these are averages, Rabbi.
Right, correct. Yeah, it could be 1/10 of a child or maybe a whole child.
Right, like I said.
Right, now why is that? Why are they having one child?
Because people want to live for themselves.
Right, because bottom line is, after you have a child, and like I said, like, you know, this kid's messing up my life.
Is it possible that people don't make quite enough money to have babies anymore?
No.
No? Okay.
I mean,
I certainly.
That case is possible, but that's not why Europe, as an entire one of the wealthiest nations in the world, is having 0.8 or one child per married couple. They're not having it because that's their value. While Israelis, even non-Orthodox Israelis, are having like 3 or 4 kids. Non-Orthodox, because it's their high value to have children. It's a function of what they think is the good of life is. So the average amount of Californian couples is to have one child. Okay, in the north, a child is an interruption of my life. Versus, the question is the child an interruption of my life or a fulfillment of my life? So the Scandinavians, like, no, I want to go hiking. I want to go traveling. I want to, I want to go to a restaurant. I don't want to deal with this annoying kid. Now, kids are annoying. I have 6. You know, they're good kids. But all kids are annoying. There's no way around that. So it has to be for a higher purpose. And Hashem does make them cute for a reason, otherwise you would murder them. Okay, so good thing we're going to be all on tape. All right, we continue. All right, let's get to our Parsha. Let's have Shannon read it out.
Can you share the screen again, please?
I'm sharing the screen again.
Thank you. These are the chronicles of Yitzchak, son of Abraham. Abraham is Yitzchak's father. When Yitzchak was 40 years old, he married Rivka, daughter of Betuel, the Aramean of Padan Aram, and sister of Lavan, the Aramean. His wife was sterile, and Yitzchak pleaded with Hashem for her sake. Hashem granted his plea, and Rivka became pregnant. But the children clashed inside her, and when this occurred, she asked, "Why is this happening to me?" She went to seek a messenger from Hashem. Hashem's word to her was, "Two nations are in your womb. Two governments will separate from inside you. The upper hand will go from one government to the other. The greater one will serve the younger."
Okay, we'll stop there. If we have time, we'll go to the next psukim. Okay, let's go to Rashi. Before we go to Rashi, look at these psukim, 19, what catches your mind? What's challenging here?
Well, she's like Sarah, her mother-in-law, in the sense that it's difficult for her to have a child.
Yes. Correct. So, in fact, not only that, Sarah, Rivka, and Rachel were all initially akarot. They were barren. What your question, of course, is, why were the imaot, why were the matriarchs barren? And they ultimately do have kids, but it's through a difficult time. Okay. So that we'll put that question wrong. What else? What else is strange, challenging?
The greater one will serve the younger.
Yep.
It seems like a contradiction.
What do you mean by why? What's the contradiction?
That the greater one is the servile one. It should
correct,
be
correct, correct, correct. So the Hebrew word is v'rav yavod sa'ir. Rav, it should be the habachor. So rav, it's an interesting use of a term, but the rav could be the greater one. It could be referring to the older one. So why, first of all, why is the Torah calling him Rav? Great. That's a good question. And also what's happening to the normal hierarchy of the firstborn, secondborn, the firstborn being the leader, the secondborn being not the leader. So that's a good question also. What else do we got?
Well,
All right, so there's more. We might want to check out a little Rashi. Check out the Rashi here. There's more. We'll go back to that. But I want to focus on, this is an idea that I heard myself from Rabbi Chait, in regards to this. The Rashi breaks up, you know, that little fragment into little mini fragments. Okay, go ahead, read it out, Rashi.
The Talmud in Ben. Ken means, and she said, if the pregnancy be so great, lama ze anochi, why is it that I longed and prayed to become pregnant? V'telech l'derosh, and she went to inquire at the school of Shem, l'derish et Hashem, to inquire of the Lord that he might tell her what would happen to her at the end.
Right, now, the problem is that there's a sort of a missing, there's like a fragment missing, because said that she said, if so, she said, why is it? Or lama zanochi, why am I like this? Doesn't tell you, there's sort of a fragmentary expression here. So Rashi comes in based upon the Midrash, the Midrash Rabbah, and fills it in. So she says, if the pain of pregnancy is so great, why did I long, or why did I desire and pray to become pregnant? Right? So basically, she's having a full regret. The pain of these two twins struggling in her so painfully, basically, like, if I would have known then what I know now, I would never have wanted to become pregnant. You know what I mean? Complete regret. So let me ask you the question number one here. What immaturity caused Rivka to regret her pregnancy?
She thought there'd be no pain. It was like all like easy.
Well, but she was clueless. She didn't see any ever woman ever have any a baby before.
Well, maybe she didn't realize the effect on her body that a pregnancy would have.
Now, is her pain of a pregnancy normal?
No, it seems like it would be abnormal.
Correct. Right. Because it says, and the children clashed inside of her. Now, having children, two fetuses clashing within you is not the normal thing. In fact, the Ibn Ezra says she went to ask other women who have been pregnant before, you know, she told them what's going on. She says, is this normal? This is crazy. Okay. So, but she basically said, like, but going back to Sean's point, she longed to have a child like every other woman, right? And she expected, yeah, there's going to be some pain, but what was she hoping for?
A very easy pregnancy.
Right, there'll be a lot of gain. In other words, most people make a calculation based upon the pain-pleasure principle, right? I'm willing to endure this amount of pain to get this kind of pleasure, right? I'm willing to, you know, pack, get into a car, wait on TSA, go through security, get shoehorned into an economy seat on the plane and fly to Barbados because I know that when I'm gonna get a cab, he's gonna try to rip me off, I'm gonna find my hotel, the room is going to be bad, but I'm going to switch the room. I'm going to get the room, but ultimately I'll have the opportunity to walk down on the white sandy beach and lay out there and enjoy the fantastic tropical breeze go over me as I enjoy a lovely fruity beverage, definitely alcoholic, as I watch the, you know, azure blue sea in front of me, right? There is pain, but there is pleasure, right? Her immaturity was that she thought that the pain pleasure principle that she would, you know, it would be worth it. And then she got rocked. Rivka got rocked by the pregnancy. Now, but she did something kind of weird. She went to inquire, the Taylor Ladrota Hashem, she went to inquire of the Lord. So where'd she go? According to this Midrash, the School of Shame. I will share with you the Rambam's son, Avraham, says, the tale of the Droshim, she went to see God. She herself had the prophecy. Because she's Rivka, she didn't get it from shame, but she got it herself. Whether she got it from shame, whether she got it from Avraham, who's still around, she went to inquire about what's going down. All right? Now, what teshuva did the pain cause in Rivka?
Knowing that her two children are destined to fight?
Well, no, but this is before she went. When did the teshuva occur? What was the, she had a teshuva moment. What was the teshuva moment?
I'm not sure.
When did she have, this is a hard question, but let's see if you guys get it. When did Rivka have the teshuva moment?
Is that when she turned to Hashem?
When she decided to go to seek out Hashem. So before, she was just, you know, complaining. She was upset that she, you know, wanted to be pregnant in the first place. You know, she just, well, you know, she was just sort of reveling in her sense of disappointment and sadness and depression and regret. And then she had an epiphany that, and my question is, well, what was her epiphany? What was her, she had a moment of self-awareness. She had a breakthrough moment. What was that breakthrough moment? I mean, I don't mean by what was, you know, what did she realize that said that she wanted to get divine insight about the situation?
Lama Zanochi.
But that's when she's in the pain. That's when she's in the immature complaining about the pain. But what is she then? Why is she then? Decide to change her tactic? Instead of being upset, she goes to an acceptance mode, and then she tries to go. She goes to an acceptance and active mode, going to seek Hashem's insight about the nature of the pregnancy. First of all, why does she begin to think that that would be a possibility? Or like, oh, I can go to the gynecologist, or I can go seek a prophecy. Like, why would she think that?
It sounds like she went to other women first, and the pain that she has is not normal pregnancy pain.
Good.
Not something that other women have gone through, and not something that a quote-unquote normal woman would be able to guide her through or help her with. That her pain is coming from something else, and the only person, if you will, who would then be able to answer why she's in so much pain would be Hashem.
Right. So, in other words, she recognized that, in other words, before she was looking at her child, the pregnancy, or the children, in a normal mother realm. Like, I'm going to have these kids. They're going to be cute. It's going to be great. I could visualize, you know, painting the room blue, you know, pushing them on the stroller down the street, you know, all these different satisfactions. And then that got sort of dashed. And then she recognized, 1 second, I happen to be married to Yitzchak, who is really the continuer of the Abrahamic tradition. Maybe perhaps that these children have a significant mission. Let's say they have an important destiny. And my narrow vision of they're just about my enjoyment, my sort of like, I now have two children who will love me, who will take care of me. Maybe it's a lot bigger than that. So her awareness, her true awareness was that she recognized that these kids are way beyond, it's not, in other words, in a certain sense, it's way beyond her. And when she made that awareness, she headed out to shame. To the shame with Noach's son, who was apparently a prophet, and then he tells her that these children are not two children, they're two governments, they're two nations, and one will rule the other, and the elder will serve the younger. Now, what information did Hashem tell Rivka? Well, I just mentioned that. Why is it important for her to know this, and how did the lesson change her view of having children? Or how is that information helpful to her?
Well, it explains the source of the pain, and knowing then that what's going to happen will maybe help her is mentally tolerate the pain, even if physically it hurts a lot.
Well, that's for sure. Number one, in other words, what's happening here is a foreshadowing of the conflict between the two boys and the two nations. All right, Shmuel.
No, sorry.
You're waving at your sister again. Okay, I got it. Okay. I love to see some familial love. All right. So the one aspect, I agree with you, Shayna, the one aspect you bring up is that, so she knows that this is a function of a much broader issue that allow her to provide a context and a meaning for her pain. What other reason, what other value could there be of being told that what, that, you, that your children will be two nations, two, ultimately two governments, and one will rule the other, and the elder will rule the younger. What is that really helpful to?
Yeah, there's a chat feature on there.
I couldn't hear that. How can that information be helpful to her?
It will be helpful in the future also.
Okay, what way?
What you're alluding to, should her sons be continuing to fight, to know this is why they're continuing to fight? But then we also see her when she puts this into practice, to when she encourages Yaakov to take Esau's blessing.
Right. So so it's also going to provide her some guidance about how to raise the children. Or if your children, if you know that your child has a different natures, what do you got to do? You got to raise them differently. You can't have a, you cannot have a one size fits all approach to child rearing. Your kids are different. They need different things. You try to put them in a mold, it ain't going to work. Okay. Now, even though that she knew that, I don't know if they were so successful in their parenting, but, the principle is good. Now, I want to universalize this to the rest of our lives. Is the maturity of Rivka limited to the area of having children? Where else do we see this issue? Such as in relationships, purchasing homes, cars, large ticket items, vacations, etc. Where do you see the issue? In other words, so basically Rivka went through three stages. Let me just review. She had stage one, where she was, you know, sort of fantasizing the joys, the pleasures of having a child. Then she gets rocked with the dissatisfaction because it was going nothing that she planned like. Then she had the awareness of that she needed to change, and she got divine insight. How would that apply to relationships in general? Not limited to having a children. So as a rabbi at MJE, I deal with this all the time. And I'll start you guys off, I'll get you guys going, and then you guys can give me 5,000 examples. So let's say, person imagines that, you know, let's say there's a guy, he, you know, I'm going to start dating for marriage, and it's going to be, it's going to be fantastic. You know, I imagine I'm going to meet my beshared, and it's going to be simple, easy, breezy, peasy, right? And lo and behold, they start dating, and it doesn't go so well. And it's not, nothing's happening. And then, of course, it becomes what? Disillusioned, depressed, and they don't want to date anymore. All right? And they get upset and they get angry, right? So what can they do? Well, they can just stay in that state, phase two, or they can have awareness, well, perhaps my expectations, what I want, are not realistic. maybe I'm going about this in a non-effective way. So, for example, the person might, you know, elect to go to a dating coach, a therapist. They may want to, the problem is maybe that they may find that, you know, I mentioned this to Sean over the Shabbos. I had a friend in yeshiva, great story. So he was your quintessential nerd guy. And he was like, he was literally an accountant and a finance guy and did not get fashion. And his whole wardrobe composed of a wide variety of polyester. Okay? He was rocking the polyester. It is a sturdy fabric. Okay? And it is washable. So there is practically, on a practical utilitarian basis, it's a winner-winner. But it's just, you know, just flat out bad, you know? So I convinced them. I said, I'm going to go shopping with you. So I had a friend who had a young adult kind of fashion store, you know, with like not too trendy, but like, you know, like casual, but like a step up, you know, basically we'd call had a wide variety of excellent dating clothing. You know, that it's like between like business casual, but up a little bit, you know, that category, like it's a little nicer. So a little trendier. So I said, you got it. I said, you shall not wear any of these clothing on a date. Nothing. You want to wear them? You're not a date? Because then, hey, we got him shoes, socks, flats, belt, shirt, nice sweater, new frames. He had like the look, the nerd, he was successfully wearing the nerdiest glasses in the universe. I don't know where he found them. Okay? Top to bottom. Okay? I will tell you, he went on a date with his outfit, and the truth is, and that woman worked out to be his wife, and she said, you know, I really like your outfit. Now, the outfit alone, if there wasn't some sort of chemistry, it's not going to make a, you know, some interest, not going to help. But if you would have showed up, you know, if the polyester convention would have showed up on that date, I don't know if she would have been able to look over that or past that or beyond that. You know what I'm saying? Sometimes it's small things that make a big difference. So he had a moment that he recognized, like, hey, I recognize I know nothing about fashion. I recognize that if I need to be on a date, I need to market myself, pack myself in a proper way. And he accepted it, and he didn't feel like, he didn't get defensive. What do you mean? This is a great pair of pants. He didn't fight me on it. I said, look, dude, you know, I would like you to melt all your clothing. You know what I mean? It's like, forget about it. So bottom line is he's happily married, but he was able to accept that. So he didn't say, no, this is how I am. Take me as I am. This is the way I dress. If you don't like it, too bad. No, he accepted. He recognized that he's not going to be successful looking like, you know, something walking off the Revenge of the Nerds. Movies 1, 2, and 3 is not going to help with the ladies. So that was a true moment, you know. So we constantly deal with that in every area of our life. There's a part of us that, you know, has a certain expectation. It doesn't get realized. We get upset, and then we don't do anything about it. We change everything. We don't change anything. The true. Rivka, she was able to go beyond herself. Her expectations about having children, and she was able to be open to considering it from a new perspective, and she was able to change and handle it. And that's really the mark of excellence in every person. Because we all are gonna, because life rarely goes according to your script. Rarely, maybe even never. Okay. So the question is, are you able to adapt? Are you able to be more realistic? Are you able to change? Are you able to do teshuva on the areas of where you're not having success in life? Are you open to getting a breakthrough? Are you open to getting expert opinion? Are you open to get friends and skilled people into your life to help you through the difficult things? It's not easy. There's a lot of resistance to doing that. Some people double down. No. I'm not being successful. It's everybody else's fault. All right. You know, so that's, I would just leave it like that. Is that idea clear? Is that a clear metaphor? So there's three stages. There's the stage of the fantastical expectations. Stage two is the, you know, being rocked by reality. And step three is either pivoting to tshuva and improvement, or just getting more angry and upset and depressed and not being open to any kind of change. And that really, in that state, that last stage, we want to be as much as we can like Rivka. Okay? That's the basic idea. Questions about this? Is it clear? Okay, so just to clarify, so I'm not so basically the essence of the title, the joy of having children, manageable pain or wonderful payoff. The truth is, it is a wonderful payoff, but it might not be the payoff that you initially think it is. In other words, yes, you having children can be a great joy, can be a loving experience, can be a sense of your future legacy, but ultimately it can transcend and be creating children who are responsible, who are independent, who are confident, who are sharing the very best values that you have to offer. And that itself, that alone is a payoff in its own right. And that's what Rivka has to go through the pain and recognize that she's really a partner with Yitzchak in a mission way beyond her personal experience. And that really is what Rashi is sort of charting her growth. And that really experience of charting growth is every struggle that we have in our own lives, whether it be relationships, whether it be work, whether it be with family, with parents, with, you know, the same thing. There's a frustration of it not working out. And the question is, am I going to just double down, or am I going to pivot to think of a new strategy to create to have a different outcome, to get sort of the divine wisdom? But Telech Lidros Hashem, and she went to see God. It doesn't have to be a prophecy. It could be a divine insight as well. And then, by the way, that's part of Teal. We also daven, the first thing we ask for in Amidah is for wisdom. Wisdom to be able to navigate the difficulties of life, that we do it in an intelligent way, that we're gifted, that our plan will be insightful, and will be creative, and will be successful. Questions? All right.
More an observation, but I think it's a good lesson to keep in mind on this Erev Thanksgiving.
Well said. Thank you, Shane. All right.
Hi.
That's Aviva.
Hi, everyone.
One of my children.
Hi.
My youngest child. Okay, so the point is that Shane, excellent point, and we got Finn. We got Finn in the house.
That was for Aviva.
That's it. Well, I appreciate Finn's commitment to the Parsha Tuesday night Parsha class. So Thanksgiving, just to speak about that for a moment, is for many people is an extremely stressful time, because the reason that the family is not together is not by accident. Sometimes they're not together by design, but then you have these social obligations that sort of put people together that have to endure each other for about 2 to 3 hours at a time, which, by the way, can be not so simple. Okay. So so the bottom line is that if you know that your strategy of interaction oftentimes get negative consequence, you want to rethink your strategy and to perhaps have a different consequence. And when in doubt, just say nothing and have a drink, because it'll be over soon. And then you can flee from the loving experience. You know, so that's the... Shana, excellent point. Thank you for the reminder. All right, guys, I want to wish everybody best a happy Thanksgiving and Shabbat Shalom. And we will return next week.